Say, Dene.
Dene. Oh,
wait, I'm not going to write the whole long room up here, okay? But this one verse is so important that I'd like to spend some quality time on it, all right? So say, Dene.
Dene.
Dichi.
Dichi.
Lekto.
Lekto.
Jinepe.
Jinepe.
Tende. Lekpa.
Lekpa.
Ndikpe.
Tsawani.
Lamten.
Shenyin.
Okay. Dene means and then, meaning he's finished with the preliminary prostrations. He's gone through the whole lineage. He's acquainted you with the lineage. And now he's moving on to the actual body of the Lam Rim. There's a part of the Lam Rim that comes before all other parts of the Lam Rim, and it's the first Lam Rim. Remember, Lam Rim can mean the whole book, and Lam Rim can mean each step. So the first Lam Rim, the first step, is called Shenyin Tenzu. Say Shenyin. Tenzu. Shenyin. Tenzu. Shenyin is a very hard word to translate. In Sanskrit, it's Kalyanamitra. And Shenyin is usually a word that's used for your relations, blood relations in Tibetan. And then Nyen means like, well, they both mean like blood relations or friend. So it's kind of a strange word. Shenyin is sort of like blood relation, brother, friend, blood brother, friend, you know, family or something like that. It's a very unusual word, but it refers to your lama. Okay, it refers to your teacher, Shenyin. Den is also a very difficult word to translate. It's the verb with what you do with medicine. Like, they don't say take medicine in Tibetan, they say den, medicine. And it means to use it or to rely on it or to take yourself to it or to take it to you. All of those things. So it's very hard to translate den. Tsu means how to do it. So this whole section, the very first Lam Rim is how to take yourself to a lama, how to take a lama, how to use a lama, how to rely on a lama, how to serve a lama. You know, they're all expressed in one word, and there's no good word in English that I know of. But it's how to relate to your lama. Okay? How to relate to your lama. And this is the all-important first part of the Lam Rim. If you never got any further, it would probably be enough. You know, and even up to the highest teachings, in the highest teachings, it is the essence of the highest teachings, in the secret teachings. So, you know, if you never got past this verse, and if you practiced it well, it would be more than enough. So, it's very hard to explain it in a really... It's hard to express it, but we'll try. So Dene means and then. It means, but if anyone's transcribed Rinpoche's tapes, he's always saying Dene, which means and then, you know, which in English is like, you know, it's like going on to your next subject. So Dene means and then. This is Tsongkhapa, right? It's 500 years ago. D means this, meaning this life. And chi means later lives. Di chi means what? This life and your later lives. Meaning all your lives. All your lives to come. How many to come? It's hard to tell. I mean, we talked about it in California. You can tell at a certain point. What point? When you've seen emptiness directly, then somebody can... You can actually, at that point, you see how many lives you have to go. 7 lives is very typical at that point. It takes an infinite number of lives to reach that point. You don't even know that there exists future lives until you reach that point. You know? So it's kind of a difficult thing to talk about because you can't believe it unless you've reached that point. When you reach that point, you see how many you have to go. And then you really believe in a future life because you saw them. And then you know Buddhism is correct, by the way, which is actually you don't know until you see them. Okay? Kind of difficult. Dichi means this life and future lives. Leksok means all the good things. Okay? Leksok means all the good things. Leksok. Jinepa means however many ever happened to you. Okay? Jinepa means whatever happened to you. However many happened to you. So this first line says, and then, for however many good things are going to happen to you in this life or your future life, okay, 된대요. What's 된대요 mean? 된대요 or 중화. It means dependent origination, but not in this verse, okay? In one time out of 1,000, this word has a completely different meaning. And I've heard great, I mean, it was my great pleasure being jealous of those who are better than me to hear all these great translators screw it up when they were translating for the Dalai Lama, you know. Tendel means, in this case, it means to get off to a good start or an auspicious relationship. Like, it's very difficult to explain, but Tendel, for example, is the feeling of a Tibetan New Year's, Losar. The first day of the year is Tendel. You have to have a good Tendel on the first day of the year. Then the whole year is going to go well. So that's why Tibetans are so intense on Losar, on the New Year. It's very important that New Year goes smoothly. Today's New Year's, right? It has to go very, very smoothly. That's Tendel. That's a good Tendel. And there's a famous story. I think it was Marpa. Who was Marpa's student? Marpa. Milarepa came to Marpa, or Marpa came to Tilopa? Naupa? I forget. Okay, anyway, one of those guys went to his teacher and, as a beginning act of their relationship, offered him a pot. And, it was empty. And they say that just because of that one, it's considered very inauspicious in Asia that you offer someone an empty vessel. You know, it, like when you borrow a plate from somebody or a cooking pan in Asia, after you wash it and give it back, you have to put a little piece of candy in it or something. It's considered very inauspicious to give something empty back. So he offered Marpa an empty pot. And then there was a big Tendel trupa, means the Tendel was messed up and it didn't work out right. It's like almost like geomancy with spaces in Hong Kong, you know. And it has to be just right. Everything has to be just right, you know. And he messed up his Tendel. And then one of the lamas said, filled it up with beer and gave it back to him and said, drink it, you know. And he didn't have enough faith. He hesitated. But then he decided, you know, because you're not supposed to drink a single drop of alcohol. But then he decided to take it, and the Tendel was fixed, or something like that. Anyway, Tendel is very important like that. So Tendel means auspicious. I don't know what you call it, vibrations or something. Okay, the right. I don't know. What do we call it? Vibes. The right vibes. Okay. Tendel. Lekpa Drikpa means to. Lidikpa means to get it right. Lekpa means exactly right. So Lekpa Drikpa means just right. Okay. Digadugas means in Tibetan. Diga means what? Okay. It's a Tibetan word for okay, and they use it as often as we use it. Okay. Dig. Yeah, dig. Diga. Okay. Dig means everything's all right. Everything's just right. So what it means is, The pivot point, the very most important moment of your whole life swings on whether or not this life is going to go well and whether or not all your future lives are going to go well. All of them turn on this one very, very crucial pivot point of. And that's what Tsala means generally, root, but here it means like, there's one, this verse is very difficult. There's one pivotal moment and one pivotal part of your whole life, which if you get it right, if it goes just right, if all the vibes go just right, everything in your future lives and this life will go absolutely perfect. And if you mess that up, just the least bit, if you have a little bit of a problem there, then it'll enlarge and something will go wrong. I don't know how to say it. It's like an atomic energy point where, you know, if everything goes right, you get a nice, a nuclear power plant, and if the slightest thing goes wrong, it blows up the country, you know. It's like fission or something, you know. It's like, I heard that if they get it fissioned, if they don't get it quite right, it's going to cause every atom to split, meaning the air would turn into, oxygen would turn into nuclear fire. And they're very concerned about it. They're doing it at Princeton. They're holding this thing up with a magnet because they're afraid if it touches the earth, it will go down through the earth. And they're trying to keep it up in the air with a magnet and try to make sure it can't get any oxygen to it, because it could ignite the atmosphere. And it's like that. It's like if you get it just right, it's a source of limitless power. And if you screw it up a bit, it's a source of limitless destruction. Okay. And what is that? Lam Dun Xin Yin. Lam means path. Dun means who shows you. And Xin Yin is that word for your Lama, your spiritual friend, spiritual guide. They call it spiritual friend. Spiritual friend sounds a little wimpy to me. This is like blood brother or something. The word in Tibetan is more like, it's family. It's blood family. It's some kind of relationship that you have with that Lama, which is beyond blood. It's deeper than blood. I don't know how to express that either. So pretty much this verse is untranslatable, okay? We can just forget it. No. But the point is that the whole crux of whether this life and your future lives go well, infinitely well, or whether they are a total disaster, all swings on your relationship with your Lama. And it's that much at stake, you know? There's that much at stake in the equation. You know, either everything's going to be perfect, or it's going to be something. You're going to be stuck in samsara for a long time. So it's a very, very crucial point. That's all I mean. It's very, very crucial. And that's your relationship with the Lama, and that's the first step of the Lama. Okay. And it gets even more intense as you get up higher in the schools and in the teachings. And then when you get to the secret teachings, it's the whole show is just how you relate to your Lama. Okay. Since it's so important, I'm going to spend a little time on it. And I think the most important thing at the beginning is to list the qualities that person should have. In other words, you can't really practice Buddhism. You can't ever really get any deep results from Buddhism. And you'll never get what you dream of unless you find this person. I mean, you have to dedicate your life to finding this person. And you have to find your Xin Yin, you know. You have to find your Lama. You will have other people in your life who teach you things, you know, who teach you scripture or who teach you meditations or who give you initiations or even things like that. But there will be in your life a Xin Yin. You will find a Xin Yin. And it's your most important job is to find the Xin Yin, you know. And I'm going to list the qualities, the classical qualities of a Xin Yin, okay, just so you know what to look for. But your heart will tell you also. I mean, it's almost like when you find them, you know it. And I'll list the qualities, but you'll know it. And I don't know what to say. We'll talk more about it, but when you find them, you'll know it's right. And once you know, then you have to throw yourself into it and just close your eyes and give yourself to that relationship. And that's why you have to be very careful about who it is. So you have to know what to look for. But in a sense, when you find them, you'll know anyway. And then you have to really give yourself to them. Your whole life. You know, the people say, you know, should I give $100 for this and that? And it's just, or Rinpoche and I were talking about people, you know, who charge for classes and stuff like that. I mean, it's not a question. I mean, money is not enough for these classes. You know, what you give to your Xin Yin is your life. You know, if the Xin Yin says jump out of the window, you jump. You know, if the Xin Yin needs $10,000, and you give, I mean, From the first moment when you meet your Shenyin, there's no sense of you own anything. You give everything. So it's kind of crazy to say, okay, you have to pay $33 for class, you know. I mean, you give your whole life to your Shenyin, and that's how you get your life back. You know, they don't need anything. They don't need anything. They don't need your money. They've achieved their goals. If they're a real Shenyin, they don't need the only thing they want out of you is one thing, which is what? They want you to be happy. they want you to get out of samsara, and they want you to reach enlightenment. That's the only payment they want. I mean, you do the rest for your benefit. But they absolutely... What are you going to give to a person who sees their future, who knows their own enlightenment, you know, who knows... who lives among angels all day? I mean, what can you give them? You know, what are you going to offer them? What do they need from you? You know, you can't. There's nothing to give. All they want from you is that you stop being in samsara. You know? So the idea of, you know, how much shall we charge for class is kind of funny. It's priceless. It's totally priceless. And when you meet your Shenyin, you give everything. And what everything doesn't mean your bank account. Everything means your whole life and your whole practice, your whole attention for what you need, and your Buddhist practice. You offer that, and that's what they really want. So we'll put up 10 qualities of a good Shenyin. Yeah.
Is there any discussion of what you're supposed to do when your Shenyin dies?
We'll talk about that. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell what? Yeah, means root. But here it means like it's the switch, you know. Like if your switch goes right, you get an endless source of energy, which is what fission promises. And if you screw it, fusion, sorry. And if you mess it up, it'll blow up the atmosphere and everybody will die. I mean, it's this kind of a crucial point. The rest of the Lam Rim, you know, we can cover in a class and a half. We will. But the Shenyin part, it's totally crucial. The whole thing turns on this Shenyin. The whole world for you, your whole future, revolves around this one tiny point, which is how your relationship with your Lama. Finding that Shenyin, and then giving yourself, devoting, I don't know how to say it, you know, reaching some kind of communion with that Shenyin. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question about the Tibet.
Yeah.
The verb that you were describing more as a reflexive verb that we have in the English language. I get myself up out of bed, but don't say that.
Mm-hmm.
You get yourself up, and I wash myself, dress myself. Those are reflexive verbs. I was wondering if in Tibet there's a particular ending to reflexive verbs, and if there are, and like you were saying, you relate to your medicine.
Yeah.
You relate to your medicine, you relate to something about the body.
In Russian it's sya at the end of a verb, and it makes it reflexive, and it's used with washing yourself and drinking for yourself. And in Tibetan they use the word for receiving, which is chun.
Is it there?
No. Mm-hmm. No, it's not used with this verb. Alright. This list comes from the Sutta Alamkara, Mahayana Sutta Alamkara, which was written by who? By whom? Sorry. Dictated. Good. Who said that? Dictated by Maitreya to a Sangha. Okay. 350 AD. Spoken by Maitreya. Okay. Who is what? Bodhisattva? Yeah. There's a big debate about it. Anyway. Future Buddhas, I guess, good enough. All right. I'm going to give you 10 qualities that are listed there that you should look for in a Shenyin. Okay. And you have to look. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, I mean, that's your main activity in life at this point, is to find this holy being. You know, you got to go find the Shenyin. If you don't find the Shenyin, you're dead duck. You know, you have to go find the Shenyin. That's the point of this class. Okay, but we'll. We'll start through the qualities to look for. But it's not like there's going to be a big debate when you find them. Say tulwa.
Tulwa.
This is the past tense of a noun or verb that you know very well, which is nduwa, which means what? Ten, which is the Tibetan word for Vinaya. Vinaya, okay? Dulwa. This is the past tense, so this means Vinaya-sized. Okay? Dulwa. Someone who's been Vinaya-sized. Which means what? I mean, they have got the result of keeping up an ethical way of life. You can say in English, controlled. Controlled. And it's a code word for someone who is leading a very good ethical life. They are keeping their three sets of vows. First thing to look for. First thing to check. What are the three sets of vows? Yeah. First is Pratimoksha, which was the subject of the first half of our class. Okay. At the most basic, those 10 non-virtues. They're avoiding the 10 non-virtues very well. Then if they got a little bit higher, they took layman's vows. If they got a little bit higher, they took novice vows. If they got a little bit higher, intermediate non-vows. A little bit higher, they took full ordination vows. But whatever they have, whether it's vows or whether they're laymen who hasn't taken any vows and who are just keeping out of the 10 non-virtues, they must be doing a very pure job about it. First kind of vows, bodhisattva vows. And then, you know, those are the 64 vows, and they must be keeping them very, very pure. And that's a different... That smells and looks a lot different than the Patimoksha vows, okay? It's a different angle, and you have to get used to that. I mean, if you're looking for a Patimoksha morality person, that's one thing. Then Bodhisattva is like, you know, throwing flowers and champagne for people, you know? And then you get up to secret. And that's secret. But once you learn those vows, I mean, if you know what I'm talking about, they must be avoiding, to the ultimate extent, the great enemy of the secret teachings. The single thought, which is the enemy of all the secret teachings. If you took an initiation, you know what I'm talking about, hopefully. They must be a master of overcoming that enemy. And you can smell that once you know what it is. You know, you can see it, you can smell it. And there are three different scents. They're all like very fine. They call it the scent of morality in Tibetan, the perfume of morality. They are keeping their pratimoksha vows and you can sense it. They are keeping their bodhisattva vows and you can feel it. And they're keeping their secret vows and you get this, incredible, joy and electricity from them because they're keeping them and you can feel it. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I think in general most people guess what the major vows are. I cannot go into the finer points in detail, and that I can't answer that. I mean, you can't. Somebody, you know, many people ask me at this point, how do you really know if someone's keeping their vows and et cetera, et cetera? I mean, you have to satisfy one person, which is yourself. So, I mean, you have to the best of your ability and to the best of your knowledge, you have to check if they are leading an ethical way of life or not. And if they are not, stay away from them. They can't help you. They will never make you happy. Just stay away. You know, don't get into it. They can have a lot of other good qualities, but if they don't have this first one, it'll never ultimately work out. So watch out for that. Yeah.
Does this person have to be ordained?
Not at all. Lama could be male, female, could be 10 years old, could be 100 years old, could be ordained, could be not be ordained, could be Buddhist, could be... I mean, a real tantric master could pretty much look like anything, and you don't know. So keep your eyes out. Okay? All right. But they have to have these 10 qualities. It's a very tricky subject, as you well know. So if you know, Dilwa refers to their practice of the first of the three trainings, which is ethical way of life, morality. But don't think of morality just in terms of Billy Graham. You know, it's much broader. It's bodhisattva morality, which has a whole different flavor, and then secret morality, which has another incredible flavor. Okay. Say Shiva.
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 Shanti, what does it mean? Peace. Okay. Shiva means peace. Shiva means die. Obviously related. Okay. Shiva means peace. Okay. Shiva means peace. This refers to the second of the three trainings, which is the ability to concentrate deeply. Okay. They must be a master of concentration and meditation. By the way, the thing about knowing the monk spells or not, I think you could go to another monk that you trust. And I think that's what, for example, Atishad did. You know, when he checked out Dipamkara, Selingpa, in Indonesia, you know, it took 12 months to get there and then checked him out. He was like a private eye. He was like a big detective. And he went out and got the poop on this guy. You know, and you should do that. You shouldn't be satisfied. You know, I see people, I was in a center, which I won't name recently, and there was a flyer being circulated, tantric initiation, no preparation necessary, and from so-and-so, who's a great master, teacher of this such and such illustrious person, knew so-and-so, and they had a picture, and that was it. And you're supposed to go and take this ultimate commitment from this person on the basis of this, you know, fluorescent flyer, you know. And it's not enough. You need to go check that person out, you know. That particular relationship requires years of intimacy with that person's characteristics before you get into that. So, say Nyer Shiva.
Nyer Shiva.
Nyer Shiva.
Nyer Shiva.
The Nyer is like a emphasizer in Sanskrit, upa, and it just means really peaceful. Okay. Okay. Ultra peaceful. Max, mega peaceful. In Wendy's they say biggie peaceful. And it means, it refers to this person must have mastered the third training, which is what? Training of wisdom. Okay. This does not at this point refer to the direct perception of emptiness. Okay. It's referring, you can have the training of wisdom before you enter the first path, which means you can be practicing the training of wisdom before you even enter the first Buddhist path. So the training of wisdom can be a much more basic, general understanding of something than what comes later when you perceive emptiness directly. Okay, so this is much more broad and much more general. Okay, it's like a general understanding of wisdom. Yeah.
So the
first one was actually the first training? Yeah. Okay. People yawn when I teach, and then I'm always calling on them, you know. Okay. Say yin den.
Yunden.
Fakpa.
Fakpa.
Yunden. Yunden. Fakpa. Yunden refers to spiritual qualities like compassion or ability to perceive emptiness and things like that. Fakpa means excessive. And it means that the person who's your shenyin should have spiritual qualities which very far exceed the ones that you have. They have to be way ahead of you. They have to have qualities that you would like to gain. They have to have already been over that territory that you want to pass over. Say it, Tsenche.
Tsenche.
Tsen means effort. Che means has, possesses. So the shenyin that you're looking for should have possess effort. Okay. Here effort means they are obviously dedicating their life to reaching the two goals, which is what? It's the ultimate benefit for themselves and the ultimate benefit for others. This is called the two goals, okay? They must be dedicating their whole life to these two goals. Reaching an ultimate enlightenment whereby they can help both themselves and others to the ultimate point. Okay? They must be living for that, obviously living for that. That's what effort means here. Rinpoche always says, it doesn't mean that neighbor of ours who spends all night under his car fooling around with a carburetor, you know. That's not effort. Effort means they're obviously working, they're obviously devoting their life to that goal. Say, Lungki Chu. Lungki Chu. Lung means scripture. Chuk means, it probably comes from the ancient word for cow, but it means rich, because in the old days when you had a lot of cows, you had bucks, you know? Okay? I remember this aristocrat who taught me to speak Tibetan, and he said, you know, in Tibet I had 943 sheep. Okay. So, Lungi Chuk means, you know, cow rich in scripture. Very rich in scripture. Wealthy in scripture. Scriptural knowledge. And this means that the Shenyin must have a mastery of the three collections of scripture. Which are? Vinaya. The three baskets. Vinaya, Abhidhamma, and Sutra. Okay, meaning the scriptures which relate to living an ethical life, learning to concentrate, and learning wisdom. They must have a broad knowledge of those three baskets. Say, Denyi.
Denyi.
Rapto.
Rapto.
Denyi.
Denyi.
Rapto.
Rapto.
Denyi means suchness, meaning emptiness. Rapto means they must have a great realization of emptiness. Infinitely preferable if they have seen emptiness directly. How do you know? Yeah, generally you're not allowed. Generally, there's a part of the experience of seeing emptiness directly is that you will never state in outright terms that you have seen emptiness directly. It's part of the experience, and the scriptures address this question: how do you know that a person knows emptiness if you're so far away from knowing anything about it yourself? How can you judge whether they've seen it? I think as the person describes emptiness, you have to see. There's these tests of a person's learning, you know. Do they contradict themselves internally? Do they contradict other sources of scripture and Buddhist knowledge that you're aware of? Do they contradict your direct knowledge and your direct experience? You know, are they internally consistent? Are they consistent with Buddhist teaching? Totally consistent. And is what they teach totally consistent with everything you have already experienced? And that's about all you can do. You know, it's this consistency question. Also, there's a test of are they devoting themselves to knowledge which is meaningful? In other words, are they in the right ballpark? You know, are they playing the right game? You know, do they spend their time struggling with spiritual things, or are they out doing something else? You know, that's a general test, you know. Especially, do they understand suffering? Can they describe suffering well? And are they working to destroy the actual suffering of living beings, which is their whole existence? You know, do they appreciate that, and do they address it, and do they spend their life addressing that? You know, that's one of the classic tests. And that's about all. I would say personally about the subject of emptiness that if a person is incapable of describing the relationship between emptiness and karma, or emptiness and leading an ethical life, then they probably don't know very much about emptiness at all. And of course, a corollary of that is if they somehow think that emptiness means that nothing matters, or that emptiness means that you can ignore ethics, then I would stay away from them like poison. Because that is an ultimate sign of ignorance about emptiness. The more a person is intimate with emptiness, the more they should be talking about ethics and compassion. Because one must go along with the other. And if they don't grasp that, then they don't know anything about emptiness. And I would avoid that person. If they're not talking about compassion and living a good life in the same lecture where they're talking about emptiness, I'd say it's suspicious. Okay. Say, Makeden.
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 Ma means to profess or to teach. It's the Bhashaka and Vaibhashaka, for example. Ke means a master. Okay? Master. Den means possesses. So possesses the mastery of teaching. A master teacher. The person is a master teacher. The commentary that I'm using, which I believe is Dhammapada, but I always get confused about these things. Commentary number S6237. We have thousands of commentaries now on the computer, and we never know. It's hard to figure out which one is which. Anyway, Make Den means two points. One is that the person has an ability to grasp the capacity of the student. In other words, they are sensitive to the capacity of the student. The ones who can handle it, they feed them more. And the ones who can't, they're aware of it and they feed them less. Like that. They regulate the heaviness of the teaching to the person. The second quality that is mentioned in the commentary is that they go at the right speed for the particular student. If the student needs to be taken along slowly, they don't exceed the proper speed limit with that student, which would ruin a student.
So that would imply a one-to-one relationship, wouldn't it?
Pretty much you really need it. And you know, by the end of this, I'm going to say what Tsongkhapa says, which is, you know, these people are extremely rare. We'll talk about that. Say, tsewe. Dangi. Tsewe. Dangi. Tsewa means love. Love. And Dangi is a difficult word. It's the Atma in Mahatma. And it means... No, it's the other part of the Mahatma.
Soul.
It means soul, but in Tibetan it means the embodiment of love. The very image of love. This refers to the person's motivation for teaching you. Okay? It refers to why do they want to be a teacher. Okay. And there's four possibilities. Alright. First one is they want to get some material gain out of you. They're hoping that you will give them money or property or anything else that they want. Okay. That's the first possible motivation. Obviously a bad one. The second possibility is they have an attachment to being respected or looked up to by other people. And that's why they're teaching. They want other people to say, oh, wow. Okay. Third possibility, they hope to get famous. Which is sort of connected to number two, right? They hope that many people hear about how great they are and stuff like that. Motivation number four is the only reason they are teaching is because they care about you. They really care about you. And they are really concerned about you. They're really concerned that you succeed spiritually. And that their whole reason for teaching is that you don't waste your life and that you reach the highest goals of Buddhism as smoothly and efficiently as possible in this life. And that's the Tsewe Dangi. So Tsewe Dangi refers to number four, motivation number four. The reason they're teaching you is only that they are concerned that you stop suffering. Say, Kyowa.
Kyowa.
Pang.
Pang.
Kyowa Pang.
Kyowa.
Kyowa means distaste for something. Sounds related to the word Kyukpam, which means vomit. Sorry. Pang means gave it up. Okay. Gave up distaste, which means they never get tired of teaching you. And they don't care how much they have to repeat something. And they don't get discouraged. That's what Kyawapang means. They keep teaching no matter what happens and no matter how you react and no matter what goes on. And they don't get discouraged. They don't get discouraged with you personally and they don't get discouraged with situations or things like that. They are teaching for a specific reason, which is that they love you. And And they're like a mother. You know, somebody who really loves someone can really ignore a lot. Rinpoche is always quoting this Channel 9 broadcast, news broadcast, where the kid has just shot four people in the subway, and they interview the mother because he's in jail and they can't, you know. And they say, what about your kid Johnny? You know, he says, he couldn't have done it, you know. He's perfect. He's wonderful. He's so free, you know. And then you see Johnny on TV, you know, like, you know, he's got... But it's this love blinds the person. I mean, the mother never, a real, you know, classic mother, never gives up on their child. And just the love just blinds them to everything. I mean, you know, your mother wouldn't resign being your mother because you were bad or something like that. I mean, a real classic mother would not tender her resignation as your mother because you didn't get it fast enough or you were bad to her or something like that. I mean, Lama really, really loves you, and all they want is your happiness, and they will put up with any kind of bad things that you do, and they do. And that's those are the 10 qualities of a Lama. Somebody asked about what if their Shenyan had passed into Nirvana. That's what you said, right? The karma to keep, we talked about it many times, but I'll repeat it. You know, 64 karmas, and they passed on. But who? What happened? Did they pass on independently? Did they pass on self-existently? I'm setting you up. Okay. What's the answer? No. I mean, if they died, quote died, you know, they got some disease, some germ came into them and attacked their liver, and they died. You know, that would be self-existent. What really happens is that your karma wears out. And they dependently, originatingly pass out of your life because you don't have the karma anymore to maintain that vision. And you don't have the goodness anymore to be around them. Which brings me to the... Oh, but someone once asked me, how do I re... What's that? You know, how do I regenerate this karma? You know, how can I be around my Shenyan and have some kind of confidence that I'm not wearing out this karma? Is there any way to achieve fusion? Less energy in, more energy out. And that is, you know, a very worthy goal, and that is probably one of the most important questions of Buddhism. And it's to really appreciate that Shenyan for what they are. According to every Buddhist scripture, that Shenyan, who's in your life as a normal person, is for you infinitely more valuable than all the Buddhas in the universe. You know, whatever they are, good or bad, blah, 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 they are your one and only connection to all the Buddhas in the universe. They, even just logically, are representing millions of enlightened beings for you because they're your only window to that realm. Is that person. So you have to recognize who they are. You know, treat your Lama as a normal guy for a day, and you'll use up tremendous amount of karma, and it won't be replaced. Appreciate who they are. You know, just reflect on how blessed you are that this being is alive in your life. And reflect on how they... For you, they are meeting an enlightened being, then you will regenerate the karma. That regenerates the karma. That emotion that you feel towards them, and it's logical. It's based on logic. There's all these logic texts that prove your Lama is a tantric deity. You know, I don't get into it. I'm not gonna get into it. But they're based on that. Just to know them is almost enough to keep them. How's that? Just to know who they really are is almost enough to keep them. Yeah.
Is there any specification of how many students you want would happen, because if he would be fully dedicated to the student, so he could say, I cannot take care of the 100
students. It gets into the question of the Lama passing away. If they are a real Lama, I mean, qualification number 11, I guess, it's absolutely no problem for a being like this to appear in another body for you. It's absolutely no problem for them to be in New Jersey and to be in New York and to be out on the West Coast at the same moment. Absolutely no problem. You just have to find them. Okay. It's almost an act of sacrilege if you don't believe they can do that. You know, of course they can do that. You know, they are not a normal being. You know, of course they can be three different people at once. No problem. Don't doubt it. If you doubt it, you will screw up that tendo, and you will blow up the atmosphere. Don't doubt it at all. Maybe it takes time to find them. You know, maybe it takes a lot of virtue to find them. And it will take a lot of virtue. But much of the virtue comes from believing that. And if you doubt it, you will burn off a lot of virtue. So don't doubt it. It really is true. They are extremely capable of being a young lady in New York, an old man in New Jersey, and somebody else on the West Coast. No problem. Why not? You know. What do you think? What did you think? You know, you want to find a Lama, hopefully, who's enlightened, and well, you think that's a problem for them? Or you don't know what a Buddha is? You don't know the function of a Buddha? Is a Buddha like stuck in a body with a bump on his head and ears and can only walk around in Bodh Gaya, you know? are they restricted to that, you know? It wouldn't be much of an enlightenment if that's all it was, you know. So don't doubt it. I mean, seriously, don't doubt it. Find them. When the virtue is enough, when your goodness is enough, you will find them. And much of the goodness, especially in the secret teachings, comes from simply believing or understanding how that's true. It's all empty. You know, every being you meet is empty. What you see is what? Up to your projections. They are determined by your good or bad deeds. They have no reality on their own. Don't diss Nagarjuna. You know. You can't say, logically understanding emptiness, that any particular being could not be your Lama. You know. You're not being logical. You're saying they're not empty. I'd say it's a sign of very, very good practice.
What's and the question? Sorry.
if things start happening to you that are very special, and more objects in your life seem special, he said, is that being close to Nirvana? I said, well, being close to Nirvana means that specifically that object called your own mind starts to get special. You know, because Nirvana is the absence of mental affliction. So if you find your mind getting sweeter and sweeter, and more moments of mind without mental afflictions, then yeah, you're projecting a mind without mental afflictions because of your past good deeds. That's getting closer to Nirvana. If your practice is going very, very sweet and you know, special things are happening to you otherwise, which they are supposed to, I would say the opposite. I'd say if they're not, then you're screwing up your practice. Something's wrong with your practice. And I like to say that in most cases it's your pratimoksha. You know, it's as basic as that. It's not your tantric initiation shortfall or your emptiness deficit or your, you know. It's normally that you engage in idle talk too much, which is a great destroyer of virtue. You know, or something like that. Or it's idle thought. Or idle magazine reading, or something like that. I'm not saying evil. I'm just saying they're obstacles from the realm of bliss. You know, so you know, Satyapandita said, don't get attached to little pleasures like the Sunday Times. You know, go for the big time. You know, if you have to give up the Sunday Times to get the big time, then what's the comparison? You know, go for it. Dewa chula chapai, dewa chumba tomisi, Satyapandita. One more question, then we'll take a break. It's a bad self-existent question. Why? Why did I say that? She said, would the lama stay in your life if you knew you really wanted him to stay or her to stay? Yeah?
Yeah, but sometimes if the lama didn't know that he would pass on, or if they neglected to tell him how much they loved him, then he passed on. So that's the basis.
You guys tell me. Is that why the lama passed on? It is in a way, because, but not in a way. In one way it is, in one way it's not. If you had the devotion to ask, that devotion would keep the lama there. The karma would the karma of asking would keep the lama. It's considered, I forget who it was, Malgal Kipu, you know, made the ultimate mistake, did not ask the Buddha to stay. There was one of his disciples. It's listed in the, Gawa? It's listed in like the five great mistakes of all time. And it was like he hesitated. But by the way, one thing about Shinyans, don't hesitate. Just don't hesitate. Just go for it. You know, when you find this, just do not hesitate. The time is very, very short. There's no time. And if you're on the verge of a Shinyan, just go for it. I mean, that's one of the most precious things I can teach you, is that, you know, when you're on the verge of establishing this link with this being, you know, a lot of people are like, they hold back a little bit, or they just hesitate, and the hesitation kills them, you know. When you're close to that connection, just close your eyes and jump, you know. Because that's the most viable thing you can get. Cool.
And what does go for it mean?
It means give your whole devotion to that being and establish the connection and hang on to that connection. You know, and don't... generally, we are very logical. My classes and my way of teaching and my training is called Tsenyipa, which means logician. You know, but when you get to Shinyans, it's total devotion. You know, and let them know, and you know, let them know, and beg them for that relationship, and keep it very precious and cherish it in your heart. And you know, it's like, just do it. You know, just open up and embrace the Shinyan, and give your whole life to that Shinyan. And you will never, never, ever, ever regret it. There is no more smart thing to do. It shows you are an Einstein of spirit things. You know? And nothing but good things will come. And I'm saying when you hesitate or you hold back a little bit or you know, you're not quite, you know, that's okay, but go find the Shinyan, you know. But don't hesitate in that search. Devote your life to finding the Shinyan and do it as quickly as you can. When you get close, then totally devote yourself to that Shinyan.
And so why did it take Atisha so long?
He checked out the Shinyan because you have to make sure they have these qualities. And it's hard to know because you don't have them yet yourself and you're going to the Shinyan to get them, so you don't really recognize them yet. And that's the catch-22. But here you have some general advice. More specifically, in our present condition, we cannot recognize the Shinyan for what they are, and we can't relate to the Shinyan in a pure way after we... I mean, if we think someone's a Shinyan, we don't even know how to embrace them in the right way. We hesitate, we do the wrong things, we say, please be my teacher, and the next day we do the opposite of what they told us to do, and I can tell you, I'm an expert in it. You know, I mean... We're like children, and it's hard to recognize a Shinyan, and then it's hard to have the right relationship with that Shinyan. But this is a guideline. But be aware that your own mental afflictions will get in the way sometimes. I mean, your own, it's a very famous thing that within a certain amount of time of knowing anyone, you start to see faults in them, and they are largely your own faults. It's just a very famous thing about psychological projection in Buddhism, that they say if they put you in a room with 10 people, within 2 weeks, you'll like 3 of them, you'll hate 3 of them, and 4 of them, you won't care about them. And it doesn't matter which 10 people you go in a room with, because it's not the people. You know. So there's this, it's very difficult. I mean, what I'm saying is, there are such shinyans. They are sitting there waiting. And it's on the homework, okay? I mean, if the shinyan has these qualities, why is the shinyan, and if the shinyan is aware of having those qualities, why? Where is it coming from?
If the shinyan is aware.
If the shinyan has these 10 qualities, and they're aware of it, having those 10 qualities, where is that coming from?
From your perception of it.
From whose perception?
Your own perception.
Yeah, from the shinyan's own perception. You know, they look down and see a person who's keeping all 3 trainings, who's doing all those 10 things right. They can look down and see that on an otherwise empty screen. Okay? They are forced by their past good deeds to see a being who is keeping perfectly all 10 of those things. What about the student? No, I mean, if the student focuses on the same being, what does the student see? It absolutely depends on the student's own karma. You know, you could see 7 of them, or 6 of them, or 4 of them, or none of them, or maybe 10 of them, or maybe 10 of them not so strong, or like that. I mean, and if the shinyan seems to pass away, that's whose karma? That's your problem. You know, do you think they saw themselves die? If they're enlightened, they didn't see anything like that. That's the emptiness of the student relations, teacher relations. That's a little deep. But the bottom line is this. I like to think of it, have you seen those Flemish paintings where they lay on varnish, you know? Like, here's this angel in the Bruges Museum, you know? Okay. Okay, maybe not just like that. I'm spitting on the Flemish masters. And they put on all these layers of lacquer, you know, layer after layer after layer after layer. And they lay paint in between the lacquer at different levels. And so it gives this, I mean, after 400 years or 500 years, there's still this incredible intensity to the colors and three-dimensionality to the colors and extraordinary. But I always like to think of a shinyan like that, you know, what level your eyes are picking up on. There are all those levels there. It's not contradictory to say that one person can be a rascal, and a half rascal, and a quarter rascal, and a not rascal at all, and then a holy being and an angel, at different levels of the varnish. And what level your eye catches on depends totally on your own projections. They are all of the above. Simultaneously, it's not contradictory to say they are all of the above. Which perception is correct? All of them are tsema. All of them are pramana. Okay? They're all valid in that you are really seeing what you're able to see. And that's pramana. That's tsema. That's a valid perception. Okay? Which one would you rather have? You'd rather live around enlightened beings, okay? And if you want to look at that level of the varnish, you know, if you want your eye to stop at that level, you have to do one thing. Good deeds. I mean, and ultimately good deeds. And what is the highest good deed? It's shenyin tensel, I'm telling you that. Okay, it's very simple. I don't say it in front of a lot of people. The highest good deed you can do is to find that shenyin and give yourself to that shenyin. And don't hesitate. Go for it. Huh?
ultimately, if your relationship to that Shunyan is realized, that Shunyan is not done.
No, couldn't, wouldn't.
No,
they would. Why would they want to leave here? I mean, why would they do that? It would be a very cruel thing. Of course, it's the same thing. But I'm just saying there is no. What I'm trying to say is, I know we want to take a break. There is nothing more precious that I can teach you. I mean, find your Shunyan, and when you find your Shunyan, just they are in love with you. All they want is for you to reach bliss, and go find them, and then just absolutely give your heart to them. You know, let them do their thing.
And it's not an attachment.
Oh no, not at all. This is a path. This is the path. This is the first lamrim. This is the first and the most important lamrim. There's nothing sweeter. I mean, there's nothing more wonderful. You just can't imagine it. And you just have to find them. Okay? Those are the clues for looking. Okay? But for each person, it will be something special. And you'll know. But what I'm saying is, when you know, don't hesitate. Just do it. You know, give yourself to them. By the way, that's a very serious question. And it's called breaking dumsik, breaking the relationship. That's why you have to be so careful before you get married. But after you get married, it's forever. You know, that's not for one life, you know. It's a very serious search, and you have to find one that can. This is talking future lives also. You have to find one that will stay with you for your future lives. You have to find one that has the power to stay with you throughout all your lives, and they do, and they will. If you find a real one, they will never leave you. So, the 18 leisures and fortunes, and then supposed to do the. Three refuges, and then I'm supposed to do the four powers, you know.
Ooh,
okay.
And it's 9 o'clock.
So the eight leisures you will get in the principal teachings of Buddhism book, note number 43. Seriously, okay? It's on your homework. So principal teachings of Buddhism, I believe it's footnote number 43. You check it out. But I think that one says the eight lacks of opportunity. The opposite of those are the eight spiritual leisures. And the homework says, what are the eight spiritual leisures? And I'm not going to go into them. Simply enough to say that to be a human in New York City, in the very year that Buddhism begins to knock on the door of America, or, you know, within that 20-year span or whatever, to have a mind that's half intelligent, to have any spiritual yearnings at all, to bump into to one of the only places where they're teaching it, you know, to have any attraction to it at all, to bump into the lineage of it, makes you, I have calculated it, it's something like 1 in 1,000,000. It truly is 1 in 1,000,000, maybe a little more. 1 in 1.3 million or something, people in the United States. You are very, very different. And you have some extraordinary virtue, each person in this room. And one thing I realized teaching was that I really believe that every person who gets as far as walking into this building has some extraordinary seeds in them. And if we take good care of them, that each one of those people could be a great teacher. I really believe that. From my experience so far, each person who has the karma to walk into this building has some extraordinary role to play in the preservation and in the spreading of this holy knowledge. You know, I really believe that. I believe each person in this room has some kind of destiny to do that. I just encourage you to go for that also. You know, just go for it. There's nothing else worth doing, actually. Which you'll find out now or later. You know, take my word for it or live a few more years. You know, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary opportunity. And I believe that if you had the karma to get here, that according to my own observation in the last few years, that it amazes me. I mean, someone this morning handed me a piece of paper, I mean, yesterday, of a translation they were working on. You know, we went over it for a couple hours. This is somebody that I didn't even think their Tibetan was very good yet. And I was walking on my way to work, and I opened up this paper, and I had to stop and look at it. And this is extraordinary. You know, I was just like that. And then it dawned on me that, like, everybody can do that. You know, I mean, like, everybody in the class, if they really... I don't mean you have to be a Tibetan translator, but I'm saying each person here, if they carefully water the seeds which you already have in your own mental continuum from your past life, that it really could be a place where Buddhist teachers are trained, and that each person here could go out and benefit many, many people. And I just urge you to think in those terms. Please don't think of this. I mean, the homework is deceiving. It looks like high school, you know. It makes it feel like high school. It's not that. I mean, it's a very holy transmission, and I believe that each person here will come to have their own circle of devoted followers, and that each person here would be saving people's spiritual lives, you know. And I don't think anything less of these classes. Don't think anything less than that is going on. It's a very historical moment. And it's also a very holy moment. And I see that each person here could do that. That's the leisure, okay? How do I get out of refuge? Refuge is very simple. You know, we recovered an ancient book by Kadampa named Dolumba, Geshe Dolumba. And it was missing. And His Holiness found a copy in Siberia about 10 years ago, and it's badly defaced. We can't read it very well. And then we found a copy in South India, and then we recently found another half a copy in Russia. And he truly reveals in that book the meaning of refuge very clearly. And it is that way in the Prajnaparamita, and I've never seen it presented so clearly in accord with the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And it says, I mean, we're talking about how you take refuge. Okay? And I'm very clear and simple. Refuge means two things. What are the two requirements for refuge? Yes. Why do you go to your mummy? Why do you go to... you're afraid of something and you think someone can help you. These are the two requirements for refuge. Something bad is happening, and then you're running to someone who you think can help you. Those are the two things going on. The bad thing that's happening is called your life. Seriously. Okay? If you don't think so yet, I mean, you're in for a rude awakening. I mean, you've had a low level of suffering so far, and it will accelerate. And it will get deadly serious, like for Laura Siegel. I mean, what was a joke has become very deadly serious now. She's in danger of her life. And she was one of the best students in these classes. She was the straight A student, straight hundreds. Now she's fighting for her life. And it has become it's not like a giggling thing anymore. It's deadly serious. You know, she's thinking of Buddhism in terms of how can I do what I have to do before the cancer kills me, you know, and she's doing it, and it's a very serious thing. So that's refuge. Refuge means life is going to kill you. In the meantime, things are going to go in their old depressing way. And on the other hand, there's this incredible bliss an incredible paradise sitting there under the veneer of the, you know, the 12 layers of lacquer, you know, and you just have to see it. You just have to be able to experience it, which all depends on your own karma, which is, you can either create karma with a inefficient machine called Pratimoksha, not inefficient, but very slow, or you can use a little bit faster machine called Bodhisattva behavior, or you can use a jet engine called secret teachings. But you, before it gets to the Laura Siegel stage, you must create enough virtue to change the reality you're in. And if you don't do it fast enough, the old reality will just wrap you up and kill you, and it'll be too late. You will not be in a human life like this anymore, probably. You won't have this opportunity anymore. So that's refuge. What is the one thing you really have to pull off before you die is to see emptiness directly. Okay? And everyone in this room has that capacity, and it's extremely difficult. The odds are not very good. You know, you have to really take it as a serious goal, and you have to time it right before things collapse. You know, it takes a certain amount of health and wisdom and etc. So, what is refuge? The ultimate refuges are as follows. Buddha refuge. You know, if on your homework it says, what's the essence of Buddha refuge? It's the Dhammakaya. Okay? It's the Dhammakaya. What's the Dhammakaya made of? What is the real Buddha jewel? I mean, there's a difference between Buddha and Buddha jewel. Buddha jewel is the thing you go for refuge to. Three jewels are the three objects of refuge. The three jewels are the three things that you're running to. Okay? As opposed to just general Buddha. The Buddha jewel is much different from general Buddha. Buddha jewel is what? There's the real Buddha jewel and the apparent, you know, and the represented, what do you call it? Symbolic Buddha jewel. Symbolic Buddha jewel is here, you know, up here, over there. Those are symbolic Buddha jewel. The real Buddha jewel is Dhammakaya, which is made of mainly emptiness. Okay. When do you meet that Dhammakaya? Directly. Path of seeing. If it was as easy as dying, we would have done it a long time ago. Because we've died countless times. You meet the Dhammakaya when you see emptiness directly. Because it is emptiness, mostly. So one refuge is intimately tied up with seeing emptiness directly. It is the emptiness that you see, really. And then that Dhammakaya and the mind connected to it have the ability to emanate all these pictures and all these guys walking around. That's not the real Buddha. The real Buddha is that Dhammakaya. What's refuge object number two? Dhamma jewel, which is also symbolic or actual. What's the symbolic Dhamma jewel? The book. Where'd they go? I don't know. Oh. Those books, okay? Those books, alright? They are not the Dhamma jewel. You could run and hide under those books and death would still pull you out by your leg and kill you. Doesn't help. The real Dhamma jewel is two things. Realizations and?
Cessation.
The cessations you get from it. What's a cessation? I'll give you two examples. Cessations can be divided into cessations that you get from seeing emptiness and cessations that don't depend on seeing emptiness directly. We call them Soso Tangok and Soso Tamingikoma. The one that doesn't depend on seeing emptiness directly is, for example, during the path of preparation, which is path number two, you reach a point at which you are so good, you will never again take a birth in the lower realms. That's a cessation. And you own that cessation forever. You can never lose it, which means you can never be born in the lower realm again. You have not seen emptiness directly yet. That's a cessation that doesn't depend on seeing emptiness directly. Then there's a thing called nirvana, which is the cessation of your mental affliction, permanent end of your mental affliction. That absolutely depends on seeing emptiness directly. It's part of the definition of nirvana. Those are the two kinds of cessations. That's the real Dhamma jewel. Cessations and the path of those cessations. What's the number one path of those cessations? The most important path.
Morally aspirational way of living.
Seeing emptiness directly. Okay, the most important one. You're getting a picture here? I mean, a lot of emptiness is in here. Refuge object number one is emptiness itself, that you see for the first time directly when you see emptiness directly. Real refuge number two is mostly seeing emptiness directly at the path of seeing. What's refuge object number three?
Sangha.
Sangha jewel, please. Which is different from the Sangha. Okay. What's a symbolic Sangha jewel? People wearing red clothes. Okay. They are not the Sangha. Jewel. You can take refuge in anybody who wears red clothes, you're going to get in trouble. Because most of them are just normal people, probably. But they represent what?
Well, people who have seen emptiness.
Yeah, people have seen emptiness directly. Okay. Arya. Okay. And that's the real refuge. I'm sorry. Sangha refuge. Sangha jewel. The day you see emptiness directly, how many refuge objects do you become? It's cool. You become two of the three jewels. You know, when people around the world light incense in the morning and go, I go for refuge to the three jewels, they are going to refuge to you. Okay? In the day you see emptiness directly, you are already two of those refuge objects. All people all over the universe are taking refuge in you.
Yeah.
The third one, you have to get to a Dhammakaya. You mean number three? I mean number one? Buddha jewel?
Number two.
Oh, you become... You gain the state of mind which sees emptiness directly. So you have become the Dharma jewel because you have the state of mind which sees emptiness directly. You've experienced it. And you become the Sangha jewel because you are one of those people who has seen emptiness directly. So you automatically become two of the jewels. You don't get to be jewel number one, Buddha jewel, until you reach enlightenment and get your own, very own, Dhammakaya. Alright? That's refuge. Okay? Why the hell should any one of those three things help you? What is to go for refuge? Do you have to see emptiness directly to go for refuge?
No.
You have to aspire to see emptiness.
You have to be running to them for protection. It's called the Yushenla Rantoki Pungyendu Rewa Chari Sambha, definition of refuge. To put all your hopes in another object in order to save you from something that you don't want, that you don't like. So you're putting all your hopes in reaching the state. That is the state of refuge. Okay. But real refuge would be some kind of knowledge. Okay. Like what happens when you see emptiness directly is that you become aware that all of the things in your life are projections forced on you by... If you saw emptiness and if you became totally convinced that every single experience in your life and every object in your life was created from your own past deeds, good or bad, you would automatically act good. And that's the only protection. There is no other protection. No person can protect you. And I've mentioned it many times. Buddha was sitting in his living room. His fellow countrymen, running away from enemy soldiers, ran behind him for his protection, and they were cut down, holding on to him. You know, can't protect you like that. The only thing that can protect you is understanding emptiness and acting on it, which is being good. And which habit eventually forces all your mental afflictions out of your mind, which is reaching Nirvana. And if you keep that up long enough, your world changes into Buddha paradise, and then you've got protection. So protection means, refuge means understanding emptiness, and because you understand emptiness, leading an ethical life. And that's all, because nothing else could ever protect you. It's not like, oh, help me Buddha, you know. It doesn't help. Can't do anything for you. Okay, got our refuge. Now, I got to finish the four forces. Sorry it's a little late. We're trying to do a whole lot of rim in three nights. We'll do this in 5 minutes. It'll be Deva 5 minutes, okay? It said that one day in the Deva realms is equivalent to 1,000,000 years on the human realm. Something like that. We'll do a Deva 5 minutes. One of the questions that came up during the Vinaya part was, can you wipe out your old karma?
People who are in California, they
They studied the Diamond Kama Sutra, and in the Diamond Kama Sutra, the Buddha says there is a way to short circuit your old bad karma. You can wipe out your old bad karma. It's of great interest. You know, refuge means you do what you have to do. Yeah.
It's not a you. Did you turn it off?
Or? It's yellow. Okay? It's telling me that.
Cool. Okay, very quickly, we're going to go over the four powers. Jetsun Kapa specifically says in this text, what is this text? Yeah, it's his own record of his own spiritual experiences, which is unprecedented. He doesn't say about this stuff anywhere else. And he says in there, you must do as I did. In other words, you must keep using these four powers over and over and over. Every day you have to keep using them, doing them, doing them, doing them. Okay? Refuge can take away your future bad karma. But what about your old bad karma? Okay? You need something to clean out that. If you take good refuge, if you understand emptiness, and therefore understand that all your experiences are coming from projections forced on you by your past karma, you won't want to do anything bad. But you still have to deal with all the old stuff. You know, the accumulations of garbage from past lives. Okay? These are the way to clean it out. Very, 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 very important. I'm sorry we don't have much more time to do it. Say, Tengi to.
Tengi to.
Tengi to.
Tengi to.
Ten means basis. This is the basis force. And they say it means that you fell down and, you know, you're like that and you push against the floor, you know. You're pushing, you need something to push against to get, you need something to get back, push against to get back up. And that means go back to the basics of Buddhism, which are two. Which is what? Take refuge and bodhicitta, okay? Take refuge and review bodhicitta. Okay. Take refuge as we just described it, in emptiness. And then bodhicitta, think about other people. I used to have trouble, a lot of trouble getting compassion or feelings of compassion, you know. Like I could think about Laura Siegel, but it wears off after a day or two. But if I really think of 5 billion creatures crawling around the face of this planet, driven relentlessly by the inability to be satisfied with anything, and that the whole human commerce is based on this, it's pretty compassion, you know, generating, you know. That's sad. That's really sad. You know, a whole city of 8 million people are burning out their lives for something that cannot make them happy. You know, and driven to the next day, you know, the next paycheck, you know, driven to the next possession, by this problem in their own mind. It's very, very, you know, it's very sad. It's a very sad thing. I don't think you need to think of more than that. It's Panchen Lama's human suffering number one. You know, that people cannot be satisfied. And that dissatisfaction will drive them in the millions on the subways to go to these little places where they spend 50 weeks a year to get money so they can get back on the subway and come back and spend 50 more weeks, you know. And it's so sad. I think it's enough. It can make you sad. So that's bodhicitta. Two things, refuge and bodhicitta. Say number sunjinbi. Oh, not that fast. Number?
Number.
Sunjinbi.
Sunjinbi.
To.
To.
Number?
Number.
Sunjinbi.
Sunjinbi.
To.
To.
Number sunjinba means to totally waste something. To destroy it completely. I like to call it the destruction power. To means power. Destruction power. I think Ragnar's sculpture is number sentimental. The destruction power. And this is the intelligent regret of an educated Buddhist. Okay? The intelligent regret of an educated Buddhist. who knows that in the very moment that you think a bad thought, or that you say a bad thing, or that you let your eyes go to the wrong thing, in that very moment, you have planted something in your mind that is extremely difficult to get out, and it will only make you suffer. And you know it. You know, you become very schizophrenic. You know, like the minute you get mad at your boss, you're like, you know, hitting his head. It's really weird. It's really weird. The more you learn about Buddhism, the more scary it is. You know, as far as what's planted in your mind. As soon as you think something, you know, as soon as you have the least bit of, I saw this guy, homeless guy this morning, he's like up in my face. I just walked out, you know, I just got up. My mom wasn't ready to meet this guy. And he's like, in my face, like, give me some money. And I'm like, and I'm like, I hated him for that moment. I was like, I hated him. And then I said, oh my God, what did I just plant in my brain, you know? I mean, what did I just plant in my mind stream? You know, the more you know about Buddhism, that's a tremendous future suffering for me. You know, so number sinjimito means just to realize that, to regret it at that moment is very, very good. And it wipes out a lot of the energy of the bad deed.
What happens, so you have this bad thought and you acknowledge it, you check yourself, and then you have the same bad thought or something. No, very seriously.
Yeah, I know.
I have it sometimes.
We'll talk, it's coming next actually. And this is the last thing tonight, so take hold. Lan dope. Nyepale. Lan dope. Nyepa means bad deed. Nyepale lan dopa means to restrain yourself in the future. Okay? To restrain yourself from the bad deed in the future. It is driven by number two. Number two says, you know, that moment of anger at this poor guy, is frankly going to cause me much suffering in the future. It's very hard to get that seed out of my mind now. 30 seconds later, you can realize, if you're really well-educated Buddhist, that you've just planted a very, very strong seed in your mind. It's going to be very hard to clean it out. And if you don't clean it out, it's going to make you suffer. I mean, you'll be depressed for weeks or something. People say, why am I depressed? Well, that's the cause. You won't be happy for weeks. Something will make you unhappy for weeks. You'll have this feeling of unhappiness or depression. It's from an instant of anger at this poor guy. Nyepale Lando Betop means you decide not to do it again. The great lamas of our lineage have said, set a time limit. Because if you don't, you will collect the additional bad deed of lying. Like, if I said tonight, in front of all you dear people who come here and make me teach so I can learn things myself, and if I got up and said, I promise, you know, after tomorrow, I mean, I'm never going to get mad at that guy again. If he shows up tomorrow, I'm definitely going to be compassionate. You know, it would be I would lie because, you know, 2 days later I would forget myself and I'd get angry again. And then I collected a new bad deed. So they say, set yourself a time limit. I like to tell people that I can honestly say that in a meditation session, before finishing the fourth power, I have broken it again. So some of them, maybe you want to put a 10-minute limit on it. Okay. I mean, ideally, I think that except for mental ones that you feel strongly about, like, you know, getting irritated with your boss or something, you can probably keep at half a day or a day if you concentrate. Pick one. Restrict yourself to one and say, for 24 hours, I won't do it again. It has a lot of power. You know, you think that just avoiding it for 24 hours and then doing it again for 364 days is not very powerful, but it is very powerful. It has a profound effect on you to decide not to do it and then not to do it. This is the main force. This is the one that drives everything. This is the one that purifies your karma. This is the one that stops your karma. Okay. People accuse me when they hear about this, especially non-Buddhists, they say, oh yeah, you Buddhists, like, it's the morning after pill. You know, very convenient. You know, you can do a bad deed the night before, and then the next morning you can just do your four powers and everything's okay, and then the next night you go do it again. But then I say, no, you don't understand power number three. If it's your intention to do it again, and if you're happy about doing it again, you're not purifying the karma. If you don't feel really bad, and if you don't really strongly intend to try to stop yourself in the future, even if it's only for one day, this does not work, and you will not purify the karma. Okay. So it really hinges on that. Okay.